Subscribe to our free newsletter. Sign up at the RN homepage.
Hello and welcome to Big Ideas here on RN Radio Australia and online. Paul Barclay with you. Thanks for joining me. How much do you know and how much do you think you should know about Australia's democratic institutions and our system of government? A senior Queensland government minister has noticed younger Australians have a poor understanding of the political system and institutions, and this applies even to those interested in working in the government arena. Now, this is not a new observation. Concerns about the dearth of civic awareness have been expressed for years. A Senate inquiry into citizenship, democracy and education found there was a crisis of civic engagement in Australia. And this paucity of civics engagement and awareness, it suggested, can erode public faith in democracy. 2 years ago, a Lowy Institute poll uncovered a striking lack of enthusiasm for democratic government in Australia. Young Australians in particular were lukewarm about the benefits of democracy. Only 39% of those between the age of 18 and 29 who were polled said democracy was better than other forms of government. So, do we need better civics education in our schools? And should the responsibility to encourage active citizenship fall solely to educational institutions? Well, tonight we're off to Parliament House in Queensland for a forum organised by the Queensland branch of the Australasian Study of Parliament Group, and we're discussing the state of civics education and citizenship. On the panel, Professor Glyn Davis, Vice-Chancellor of the University of Melbourne, a former political science academic and former head of the Queensland Premier's Department. Professor Barry McGaw, Professorial Fellow in the Melbourne Graduate School of Education and Chair of the Board of ACARA, the Australian Curriculum Assessment and Reporting Authority. Dr. David Hamill, former Minister in the Goss and Beattie governments in Queensland and now Chairman of the Australian Red Cross Blood Service. And John Paul Langbroke, Queensland Minister for Education, Training and Employment and a former leader of the Queensland Opposition. He's noticed, anecdotally, that young Australians on the whole have little idea about how they're governed.
Well, Paul, it probably comes from, as I travel around schools as well as universities and meet students who say to me that they think they'd like to be involved in politics. And I've found that some of them are, I think, confused in this modern era of media. They confuse politics with celebrity. And because of that, they almost say, oh, I'd like to get into politics as though I'd like to be on Australian Idol. I'd like to be, you know, one of those cooking shows. And that brought home to me that when I actually spoke to some of them, they had no sense of it apart from I've seen people on TV, and that means that's something that I'd like to do. So that was probably the first of the germinal sense that I had that, you know, people had a bit of an idea about they'd like to do this, but they weren't quite sure what it was.
So it was the element of fame that had attracted them to work in this arena in the first place rather than necessarily any active citizenship or wanting to be involved in the political process.
Yes, and I think we sometimes see that, especially at the times of federal and state elections, when you'll see political leaders who go into schools and they're surrounded by adoring fans. If you ask a lot of those students who those people are, beyond the leader level, below the leader level, I think most people wouldn't have a clue.
I suppose the difference is this is a self-selecting group of people who want to work in government, yet even they don't have the basic understanding of the institutions that they want to work in.
Well, obviously, that's a bit of a generalisation. I suppose that, you know, I wouldn't say that about every person who's tried to work.
Well, that's
with
a relief.
Yeah, exactly, exactly, yeah. But it's still surprising how few people actually understand the workings of our system, and I think that is something we can sheet back to the fact that students who come here to the Queensland Parliament will often be here in year six when you're 11 or 12 years old, and then you may never, depending on your subject selection, learn anything more about politics until, and maybe even then, maybe not even when you go to vote for the first time.
Mm. David Hamill, does this accord with any experience you may have had when you were in politics all those years ago?
I'll try and leave the names out to protect the not so innocent, but I recall very vividly, shortly after being elected, coming into this place, into the parliamentary library, and couldn't help but overhear a conversation that was going on between another recently elected MP and a couple of the librarians. And this MP, who I might say was a former teacher, was having trouble getting the head around the concept of a statute and what a statute might be. And to me, it was a very powerful message as to the dearth of real understanding about system of government, how it works. And this is a case of someone who's just been elected to Parliament. And I think that speaks volumes.
That's quite incredible, actually.
It's true.
I heard a story and I was almost certain that it was apocryphal, and now perhaps I'm wondering whether it was. And that was when the, was it 10 or 11 One Nation MPs were voted into power in Queensland, that they got together for their introductory orientation meeting, and one of them piped up in the middle of the meeting and said, "When are we off to Canberra?" After hearing that story that you just told me, perhaps there is a germ of truth in
it. They may have known more.
Do you think it's getting worse, the public awareness about these issues?
Look, I think the problem is a deep-seated one and a long-standing one. I think that if I can just reflect, I mean, I'm sort of getting on, but I recall in my time at school, certainly into the high school period, the only students in high school who had a brush, if you like, with matters to do with civic issues, government and so on, were those who were probably at that stage destined to be finishing high school at the end of year 10. For those students who were doing perhaps academic sciences and so on, it was like ships in the night. There was no contact.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that in Australia we are suffering or seeing the result of intergenerational neglect of civics education. And so it's not just a case of singling out young people. You don't have to go very far across the community to find that there is, in fact, a serious lack of understanding as to how we are governed and how the system works. And I believe it's actually compounded by the fact that there is an enormous amount of US, particularly US-sourced product in the popular media, where people are dialing 999 and talking about their constitutional rights and getting their phone call and talking about the elected officials and all the rest of it. All of these concepts might be fine on TV, but they aren't concepts which are germane to our political system and how it operates here.
Watching too much West Wing, perhaps.
No. It's nothing like West Wing. I mean, it's more the sort of the cops and robbers type shows. And the fact is that there is a lot of confusion. I mean, people don't necessarily, because they don't have the information, don't necessarily distinguish as to what is the commentary that is US-sourced, US-based, and wonder, how does it relate? In fact, they assume it does relate to how we are governed here.
Mm.
And I think that's a real problem, because at one level, it can help explain a degree of frustration and leading to alienation in terms of the political system. If you don't get it, you don't understand how it works, and the things that you do think you understand, you find aren't working here.
Mm.
And they're not working here because they're not part of our system.
I will get Barry to respond in a moment, but Glenn, I suppose you've got two points of reference, at least two points of reference on this debate. One is you run a major Australian university now, so you are presumably in touch with the young educated kids of today. And secondly, you ran the Department of Premier, so you were very much hands-on in the mechanics of government. Has what you've heard so far resonate with you, and perhaps draw on either one of those two hats when you answer the question?
Thanks, Paul. I agree with everything that we've heard, but it's important to remember how ancient a concern this is. If you read The Republic by Plato, there's Plato complaining not only about the youth of today, but complaining specifically that democracy can't work because the people have no virtue and no wisdom. And since they have no virtue and no wisdom, you cannot build a system of government on these people. So, you know, this is more than 2,000 years old, this concern.
There was no golden era of democracy.
There was absolutely. This was in the height of Athenian democracy, and there's the judgment. It's interesting that that's the view through most of human history, or Western history, to be accurate, about democracy, and only in the 19th century do you really get a return to democracy as a form of government. And de Tocqueville, when he goes to America and looks at it, says, you know what's amazing? It looks messy and chaotic and incoherent, and yet these are people who stumble their way somehow to some very fine judgments on really important issues. And the nice thing about democracy, he notes, is the capacity to correct all the time, to make a mistake, to understand, which is what Winston Churchill was saying. The thing about democracy is you make every possible mistake. Hopefully you only make it once, but you can actually do something about it, retreat, try again. So we have to be cautious because we have to compare the genuine and, I think, absolutely legitimate concern about understanding of our system with the reality that we live in. People might not understand how this Parliament House that we're meeting in works. They certainly don't understand the detail of how constitutions operate, yet they'll have a pretty serious sense of whether the health system is doing what it should do, whether the schools are properly run. So we have to balance, we can always do better, against the notion that we have a system in which most people, most of the time, are going to have a pretty thin knowledge of political institutions, and yet we can and do and must trust them to make the really important judgments.
Are political science academics today saying to you that their students seem to be less educated and less knowledgeable about the basics than they were 10 or 20 years ago?
No, that's not the rhetoric. The enrolments in political science are pretty strong across the country. The University of Melbourne has a education philosophy that emphasises a broad education first before people do graduate work in a particular profession. So we have more than most. We have about 1,100 undergraduates doing political science.
Wow.
And so that's a very substantial group of people, and that matters because many of the people who go on to do law and other subjects will have a reasonable foundation. But of course that's still a tiny proportion. A minority of Australians still go to university, so that's a lot of people, which is why I guess I'll be very interested to hear from Barry around what's happening in schools.
Quickly, David,
just a quick observation,
we'll
though. I mean, political science departments seem to be doing fine. What seems to be the pattern, though, is the study of Australian government is not doing well. Numbers enrolling in studying Australian government are declining. I mean, I don't want to be so much on throwaway line, but there's big interest in peace and conflict, international relations. Everyone wants to be Secretary General of the United Nations. And the study of domestic political science is really under
not
a
as
lot
sexy,
of,
is
lot
it,
of,
for young undergraduates?
It's not seen to be so sexy. There's some great stories, but there's not seen to be quite so sexy. And I think there's a story that's probably not told very well in this day of utilitarianism in terms of education, that if you look across the community, it's not about simply working in government. At a time when governments, for example, are outsourcing so much of what they do to the community sector, to the private sector, business, community organisations, not-for-profits and so on have just as much interest in understanding how government works as do those working right inside government. And I don't think that's a message that's well understood in the community.
Barry, how much of what you've just heard and the cumulative concern that seems to be in the public about lack of understanding of basic principles of democracy, how much has that got to do with the parlous state of civics education in Australia?
Well, let me start with one point first, which is that every time there's a problem in society, the presumption is the schools have caused it and the schools can solve it. There was a dog attack on a child in South Australia, so pet care was added to this primary school curriculum.
Looking after dogs.
Yeah. How to train them, and so on. So we always have that as a background issue. How much do we expect the schools to deal with issues that the society itself isn't dealing with? Then you ask the question of, well, to what extent does the learning that the adult society has about politics and government in Australia come from their everyday experience of politics and government? We're surrounded by it, And people's attitudes to it, people's knowledge about it, is shaped as well by that as by what they learn in schools. And I think one of the problems is it's the theatre we focus on when we do that. So it's Question Time that gets telecast, not the real business of government at all. It's the adversarial part. Of course, it is theatrical. And because it is theatrical, then it becomes more theatrical and it becomes less like the real business of government. So I just make that as a sort of starting comment. But let me add some data and a little bit of more recent history. In 2003, the education ministers initiated a survey of Year 6 students and Year 10 students' knowledge of and attitudes to civics and citizenship. And that's been done every 3 years. So the last one was last year, 2013, and we're about to publish the results. We didn't, at the Australian Curriculum Assessment and Reporting Authority, have responsibility for these, obviously. In the early years, we only came into existence in 2010, but we now run it, and we're about to publish the most recent one. I can tell you that students' knowledge about civics and citizenship issues in Australia has not changed in the period from 2003 to 2013. Their level of engagement with issues has significantly increased in this last period. Mm. It's only small, but it's statistically significant. So there's more willingness to engage. Always much higher with girls than boys. Mm. The knowledge is better with the girls. The level of engagement is better with the girls than with the boys. But so we know that. I can say a little more about that later if you like. But when the scales were developed for the knowledge scale, a proficiency level was defined for Year 6 students and for Year 10 students using classic procedures for experts agreeing about what would be to be proficient at that age level and this age level. Well, the numbers of students around the country who are proficient is just over 50% at Year 6 and under 50% at Year 10, and that hasn't changed. So there is a dearth. Mm. Now, if you come to the other side and say, well, what are the schools doing about that with curriculum issues? In 1989, when all the ministers met in Tasmania and issued for the first time what they called a Declaration on Common and Agreed Goals of Schooling, they added civics and citizenship education. And there was no desire at that time to develop a national curriculum, but to make a nudge in that direction by developing a framework, as they called it, around which a curriculum could be constructed. And there was one on civics and citizenship, statements and profiles. I think its impact was limited. The Discovering Democracy document materials were developed, and that helped.
Under the Howard government, wasn't it?
Under the Howard government for those schools that used it.
Look, I'd like to get a response from the Minister to this. This is not actually a discussion, I think, where there's a terribly large degree of partisanship within it, but I'd just like to get your sense about how well you think your schools are performing in terms of civics education, some thoughts you might have about how that could be improved. And I know there's a curriculum that's just been put together, which we'll talk a bit more about later on, and perhaps whether that could improve the situation.
Well, Paul, I think that the schools are a reflection of what's happening in the wider community. So when you come to Parliament and you are very aware of the parliamentary debate and what's on the Hansard, David Hamill's point before about having a member of Parliament who didn't know what a statute was probably reflects the fact that it may not have done law, but because you don't need any qualifications to do this job, to become a member of Parliament. But when you come here as a member of Parliament, and I've been one for 10 years now, you know, you get pretty caught up in some things that you weren't even aware of before you became a member. Look at this speech that I read. Well, I'd get home, I'd say to my wife, I gave a great speech. Hans, would you like to read it? No. Go and read to your son, is what Stacey would say. And I became aware that, gee, I'd given a great speech and this is pretty impressive. I'll read it. And then I think, what am I going to do with it now? Hopefully someone else is going to read it. So you've got to keep that in perspective. And that's what happens in schools as well. People are concerned with their day-to-day lives. I'm talking about grown-ups as well as their children. So as I look around in this Premier's Hall where I look at all the portraits of our former Premiers and you think, well, you know, how much is that relevant to someone who's in Year 6 and are they going to remember that? And we have this debate nationally as well about whether people can remember our first Prime Minister. Ask Americans if they can list off, they can name every one of their presidents. Now, I'm not saying we need to do everything that the Americans do, but I certainly, being in this job, love it when young people are interested in the things that I do, and I'm always trying to encourage younger people to get involved. The ones I meet in my schools, to answer your question, generally are more interested in what I'm doing. They're often school leaders, and they are the sorts of young people who are interested in these sorts of debates. I want to have more young people interested, and I want to make sure we encourage that. So I think we do need to look at where we might do it, especially at a state level, because David's point was made before about whether we have much university study about Australian government. As I understand it, there's none in Queensland about Queensland government.
Would democracy be improved? Would you be held more accountable? Would the quality of politics and politicians and decision-making be elevated if we elevated the standard of knowledge and discourse amongst the general population?
Yes, of course. In any field, if you have more discussion about it, more debate, more argument, it's going to lead to more robust standards of the people who are practicing it. And you're going to have, and as I say, the more people you have doing it and just debating it, we're going to lead to people who actually understand that we do make a difference. Politicians do make a difference. And in fact, to get anything done, you actually do need politicians to do it. Mm. There's nothing that, you know, that I find more dispiriting than, for example, at the Gold Coast, where I come from. The Gold Coast Bulletin has a column that has underneath it as a sub-banner, Poly-Free Zone, where it's actually asking citizens what they'd like to see at the Gold Coast. To my mind, that implies that what we do if we didn't have these people who basically get in the way when we're there for the benefit of our own communities anyway, and we definitely want to work with everyone, including the media, to make sure that we get the best for our cities and for our towns and for our regional areas.
Mm. So, Barry, the civic and citizenship curriculum, which you've overseen in your role as the chair of ACARA, has this been a direct response to a demonstrable problem?
Well, I suppose a fairer way to say it is a response to the ministerial decision that this ought to be an important part of the curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Max Angus, who's later a professor of education at Edith Cowan, did a survey for the Australian Primary Principals Conference on how primary schools spend their time. This is across the country where they had curricula that were broad and rich, and in many schools they spent their time doing almost nothing but literacy and numeracy. This is pre-NAPLAN. This is not NAPLAN forcing this. This is where they focused because they saw that as the main part of the game. And it was more true of schools that the teachers saw to be in disadvantaged communities. So one of the things that now having a national curriculum does is actually explicitly create space for things in a way that wasn't true before. And so there is now a curriculum. You can see it on the Australian Curriculum website, actually. It's there. It's year 3 to year 10. So we avoid the problem that I had and that the Minister spoke about before. I did no geography once I hit high school in Queensland. I did no history once I got to year 10 because I did just maths and science and French, but no humanities or social science other than English and French. And a lot of us had that lot. Now they will do civics and citizenship to year 10. It's only a small part of the curriculum. It's about 20 hours a year through each of the years. But a school can concentrate that 20 hours, and doesn't mean you do a fraction of an hour each week for the year. You could organise your teaching in a way that gave some substantial attention to the topic. And the curriculum, starting at year three, begins with the things that are close to a student's experience. It's the way history works as well. Study your local community, study the history of the people who live near you, where did they come from, and so on. So in this, it's you first look at rules and laws. How do we make rules? How do we decide when a rule needs to be changed? What are good rules? What are rules that you think ought to be changed and so on? They move through. And by the time they're in year 7 and 8, they're studying the Australian Constitution and its role in our society. People say students know nothing about it, but it's there. Of course, the next question is to get the resources behind it to help the teachers teach this if they themselves don't know much about it. But there is now a curriculum that's more substantial than we've had before.
And do the kids want to study it? I mean, that's the other thing. Is this going to be like eating your greens? They're forcing them to wade through this tedious material about crusty old institutions that they don't give a rat's about?
Crusty old blokes and women.
I think one of a point here that needs to be made is that I think this is a very welcome development in embedding understanding of civic education in the curriculum, and that's been the thrust of these initiatives in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. The broader point that we were addressing, I think, is the fact that over a long period of time, the area had been neglected. And so we have a very significant part of the population who have not had a similar sort of exposure, then I would hope that these initiatives of the more recent times will bear fruit 10, 20, 30 years hence. I dare I say, this is one of the great challenges with education and curricula, that the outcomes are not something that you can see as short, as they're not short term. And but by embedding civic study in curriculum, over time, hopefully, we'll reap the benefit.
Can I put it to you, Glenn? Could it be, as I read somewhere, that teenagers have little interest in politics because politics has little interest in them? They do seem to be frequently spoken of as a problem that needs to be dealt with. Binge drinking, graffiti, school attendance, social media abuse, the conversation around young people that is frequently led by our political leaders does not seem to me to be a conversation that's necessarily inviting them into the tent for a discussion.
I was struck by Barry's earlier point that it's young women who grasp so quickly the not only the content but the implications, and here we are, a panel of crusty old men.
Speak for yourself.
Because when you think about teenagers, there probably are significant gender differences about how people deal with these concepts and think about them. The applicability to your own life is really important in anything you teach. If people can't see the relevance, they struggle to remember it, which is why youth parliaments and all of those devices that schools use to embed the importance, including the student representative councils and other ways of getting people to see that politics plays out at every level in life. It isn't just something that the minister and his colleagues do here in Parliament House. It actually happens all across our lives. You might think politics is not relevant to you until you ask who gets to be the school captain, who gets to make the decisions around here, and how do I get a say in these choices. It's not difficult to make politics relevant to everybody, including to teenagers, and great schools do that.
Well, dare I say, Glenn, that the argument that you're in the middle of right now over the deregulation of university fees has, for better or worse, engaged a whole cohort of people who up until, nothing like self-interest actually to engage you, has engaged a whole cohort of people who have not paid much attention to the political process and are now and wanting to be heard about it.
That's exactly right, and the marching season has begun because we're about to have a very difficult public debate about the future of higher education, and fundamentally it's a debate about who pays, whether it's the taxpayer or whether it's individuals or what combination of those two get us there. And that is a debate we've not had. People haven't been interested enough to have. It takes a substantial change like the one on the table before you can actually have a conversation in public. If you ask university leaders, they say the most frustrating thing about this is we can't engage anybody else in the conversation about what is the future. But now we're going to have very substantial public debate. It has to be a good thing, and hopefully the outcomes will reflect the fact that many people do have strong views.
Part of the problem, of course, John Dawkins had in the late 1980s when he introduced HECS.
Probably the last time we had
that. And the problem with the debate, unfortunately, is that a lot of the people who were leading it, myself included, didn't pay a jot for the university degree, which we are constantly reminded of by our younger folk.
Yes. Look, in this discussion, we're at risk, I think, of casting citizenship as only as an issue of politics and government. When you survey students' attitudes, they're much broader than that. I mean, the most important citizenship issues that or behaviours that the students identify in the surveys are protecting the environment, promoting human rights, benefiting the local community, and learning about Australia's history. They're the ones that they nominated. Fewer than half of Year 10 students think it's important to discuss politics. But they think these other issues are important. So if you cast it more broadly and people have a sense of issues with which they can engage in a hope of effecting some change, then their understanding of the political process may well grow.
It does raise this question: who should be responsible for equipping the citizenry with the knowledge they need to be engaged citizens? I mean, is this...
The schools and the curriculum certainly play a crucial role, and that's why we've now got a curriculum that has some prospect, but of course the proof will be in
Are teachers culpable in any way in this? Some say that in the past they've ignored the civics curriculum because they themselves don't know enough about the issues that they're compelled to teach.
Oh, yes. I mean, that's said of a lot of things, of course, and it's true in part. I mean, one of our problems in primary school in numeracy is that many of the people who are attracted to become primary school teachers themselves are fairly math-phobic, didn't do much maths past year 10, and are now the ones who are teaching those skills to our students. That has to be dealt with. One of the problems in English, frankly, is the reason schools don't teach grammar is most teachers didn't learn grammar. Mm. I'm asked, how are we going to teach grammar, which the new curriculum requires, when the teachers didn't learn grammar? And I say, well, they can learn it. It's easy. I learned it at primary school.
Professor Barry McGaugh. You also heard from Professor Glyn Davis, Dr. David Hamill, and Queensland Education Minister John Paul Langbroek. You're with Big Ideas on RN and online. I'm Paul Barclay. Tonight, we're at Parliament House in Queensland, talking about civics awareness and education. Remember, you can podcast or stream Big Ideas from our website at abc.net.au/RN or via iTunes, and you can follow us on Twitter at RN Big Ideas. Importantly, says John Paul Langbroek, it's not just the responsibility of schools to impart civics education. Parents play an important role as well.
Rather than going to our teachers, and I, of course, as the Minister for Education, Training and Employment, I get to hear about lots of views about teachers.
Yep.
But teachers only have our students for 13% of the time. If you take every day that people are at school from 9 to 3, less public holidays, etc., out of the whole day, so out of the whole year, it's 13% of the time. So what that tells me, what I try to do when I'm minister, as minister, I try to say we'd like parents to be more involved. Mm. And really, that's the crux of your question, of the answer to your question, I think. And that is, if parents aren't interested, because remember, they're concerned about their mortgage, their job, their getting to school for the kids, etc., and they're not interested, and they say to kids who may not be watching it on television, well, that's nothing that really has anything to do with us. That, I think, is the crux of
I totally agree. I can recall the precise moment that I was politicised as a 13-year-old in 1975 when the Whitlam government was turfed out.
Same here.
And where I was essentially not even young enough to have chosen sides, really, which side of the political fence I identified with, but there seemed to be something wrong in my 13-year-old mind with the democratically elected government being turfed out. But I remember mostly the arguments around the dinner table, because my parents didn't hold that view at all. They saw the Whitlam government as just about the worst thing that had happened to Australia, and somebody had, restored sanity to the country. And I wonder whether, presumably kids still argue about politics with their parents.
My 17-year-old certainly does.
Certainly my experience.
Mine do too.
A bunch of very opinionated young men around the table who would never hesitate to sort of put their dad in his place when...
Do you buy that argument, Glyn, that young people are disengaged from politics?
Not at all, and there's just no evidence for it. Barry rightly says that the data hasn't changed while we've been recording it. I suspect if we could go back 50 years, the data wouldn't be much... No. So it's worth remembering a couple of things. Why did we get compulsory universal schooling? We got it because we were becoming a democracy and people were deeply concerned that we'd have a population that didn't have the skills to participate in a democracy. Democracy drives schooling, not the other way around. But the other question to ask is, why do we get compulsory voting? And we got compulsory voting because in the 1920s, the number of people turning out to vote was falling so dramatically that after the 1922 federal election, when barely 60% of the population turned out, a private member from Tasmania put a bill up saying we need compulsory voting so that people will take responsibility for the outcomes of government and engage and pay attention. Mm. That went through, and we've had compulsory voting ever since, one of the handful of countries in the world. That's a device intended to say to everybody, you've got stake in this, and you better be thinking.
Barry, what's been the response to the draft civics curriculum?
Well, it was only just finished at the end of last year, and it's now available for schools for systems to use. The different states and territories are determining the schedule of implementation, and some are getting ready. South Australia's getting ready for this and others. But the first full-scale implementation will be 2015, not this year, because it was just finished in November. And in fact, the last set we put up at the end of last year were in a sense, there's a form of words we have on the website. They're noted and available for use, but they're not formally endorsed until Minister Pine's review of the Australian curriculum that Donnelly and Wiltshire are conducting has been delivered. Mm. So they're there. The states that wanted to get on with it asked if they could, and the ministers collectively, including Minister Pine, said, yes, you may. So they're there on the website for those that want it, and it means they're also there on the website for anyone who wants to see it. Mm. That's the one advantage of this curriculum, is that it's entirely available electronically. Everyone can see what it is.
We don't have time to talk about it in depth here today, so I do suggest to people to get on the web and have a look at it. Minister, what are your thoughts about the curriculum?
Well, I'm interested when we hear about the debate about it being reviewed, that I like to think that it's not from a left-right perspective. Mm-hmm. It's about saying, look, we brought this in 2 or 3 years ago. Queensland were amongst the early adopters. Yep. Once again, when you actually ask people, including members of Parliament, about what they know about the Australian curriculum and how many subjects it's in, they really can't often tell you. Mm. That it's actually in 5 subjects. Not every state has adopted it. And for some people, rather simplistically, they think that it almost is like a series of books that means that anyone could be a teacher. Mm. And that's something that I've learned in this job, that I've had to tell a few people about some of the facts. But, it's something that is certainly been welcomed in Queensland. We've also found, as I think Barry McGaugh mentioned before, that after our first NAPLAN results in 2008, which were pretty poor, that we had a group of teachers, coming back to your point about teachers, who hadn't been taught how to teach reading. Mm. So those issues about grammar and reading and maths ability are ones that are constant challenges for us as we come towards a summit accord that we're going to have, where we talk about the future for Queensland over the next 30 years.
And the task of a primary teacher is difficult because they have to span the entire curriculum. Secondary teachers focus in their own specific area, and it's much easier. They've been trained in it usually, and they work in it, science or history or politics or whatever. And so it's a question of how you resource the primary school teachers to do it. Now, there's an organisation called Education Services Australia. It used to be the Curriculum Corporation. And it has a very large electronic database of resources, which includes the Discovering Democracy materials. Mm. And they are all available on a website, but most importantly now, that's a website you can access through the Australian curriculum. So if you're a teacher saying, I'm teaching year 4, I don't know much about what I have to teach in civics and citizenship, what does the curriculum say? You can immediately be taken to all the relevant resources for dealing with that set part of the curriculum.
But in order to bring this curriculum to life, in order to make it enticing and exciting, it has to be something other than boring old institutions. It has to give a sense of the contest of ideas, of policies, and is this where you get into some contested terrain around the curriculum, that at the end of the day you're going to have teachers having to talk about political ideas as well, and prioritise what are the important moments in Australian history, what are the key institutions, what are the key arguments that we should be having? These are subjective points of view.
Good teachers can do that, of course, raising what are the issues, what are the points of view, without taking a side in that. I mean, it's interesting in Victoria, the most popular history course for those students who persist with history to year 11 and 12 is a course on revolutions.
Is that right?
Yes, Australian history enrolments have declined, but the course that attracts the students is one on revolutions. And of course, you can't study Australian history if you're studying revolutions.
Obviously, the basis for knowledge about civics education, Glyn, comes in our schools, our primary school, and then into high school. But what about universities? I mean, what responsibility should they take? Are university degrees, notwithstanding your comments earlier about the healthy enrolments in political science, generally speaking, they've become more vocationally oriented. The pure arts and humanities courses don't seem to be as commonplace these days. A lot of media studies and journalism degrees have replaced them.
I know that's the universal view, but if we...
No, it's not the university view.
If we take your birth year...
That's not true.
1962, and we say, what were the enrolments in arts at the University of Melbourne in 1962 as a proportion of the student body? They were about 21%. What are they in 2004? They're about 21%. There's been remarkable stability. Mm. It's moved around, more people doing business, less people doing other subjects. But if you look at the overall distribution of student interest, it hasn't changed a lot in two generations. So people's interests are enduring. And I was just thinking about Barry's very informative answer a moment ago, and thinking the other thing we can do in high schools rather than primary schools is introduce philosophy as part of this conversation.
Mm, yeah.
And my colleague and co-author Peter Bridgman argues, I think very effectively, that there's a direct link between civics education and ethical behaviour. I mean, one of the reasons you want civics education is not just so people will know about institutions, it's actually how should I behave in these circumstances, what's a reasonable test. And the frightening thing when you have people who don't understand the institutions is they also usually don't understand the logic of why you separate powers, why you recuse yourself if you're part of the decision. And there's those practices that we assume happen in politics all come from a philosophical base about what is reasonable behaviour and what's fair. Now, if you want a question that animates young people, what is fair and what is justice, are powerful, whether that's in high school or universities, and look at the number of people around the planet who've signed on to watch Michael Sandel's courses online, which just tells you how strong that interest is. Mm. There are other ways into civics education, and philosophy is a very powerful way into that, and one that informs all of our choices, which is why we might want to broaden what we think about civics and think about what are the philosophical content that we also want to share. And that is a very attractive area for everybody, but in particular for young people, as demonstrated by the enduring enrolments in courses that deal with those subjects, as I've said, over the last 50 years.
The Year 3 to 6 Australian curriculum, Civics and Citizenship, deals with recognising different points of view, justice and fair play, contemporary issues, why and for whom decisions are made, how decisions can be made democratically.
Mm-hmm. Which countries do this well, Barry, civics education?
Well, the Americans have exactly the same complaints we have, that they certainly do it. They all have to do the courses, but it becomes so much just the structure of government, the organisation, the institutional arrangements, that people find that less interesting. Now, we've looked around the world to see what we think is the best that's being done in order to do better.
So this debate we're having now is occurring in pretty much every Western democracy in the world, is it?
It's occurring all over the place, yeah, sure, because... you know, another issue that ministers worry about... if you look internationally, is the changing nature of the societies they have. See, we've got two general capabilities we deal with through the curriculum, including this one. One is ethical behaviour, and the other is intercultural understanding in a society that's secular, multi-faith, and so on. Well, when I was at the I was director for education at the OECD in Paris. We held a meeting of education ministers, and they said that one of the things that they were concerned about was decreasing cohesion within their societies and how schools might contribute to that. And I mean, they were all like us, mostly. Some of them were older women, mostly older men. And they tend always then to say, but when I was young, there were lots of shared experience in our lives as we grew up that created the society of which we all feel part. But that isn't true now, they said. And some of them actually said, the only thing that's common is school. And I said to them, actually, school isn't common in most of your countries. Schools divide on gender in many cases. They divide on faith. They divide on social class. The only thing that's common is schooling. And so the question is, in what way can schooling contribute to people's sense of a cohesive society to which they'll contribute? And that's why you have to, without changing the organisational arrangements of schools, have a curriculum that deals with issues of intercultural understanding, ethical behaviour, and so on.
I suppose the point I was getting at when I misquoted the statistics around arts courses was the sense that you get these days that kids understandably are wanting their higher education, upper levels of high school and university, to make them, as the phrase goes, job ready. They're very focused. And this is understandable because it's a competitive labour market out there. There's high rates of unemployment. Kids want to be prepared. They want to maximise their chances. So I just wonder whether or not they see this stuff about being a well-informed citizen as being terribly important in the broad sort of
second order
makeup of qualities that they think they need.
Well, let me give you an interesting current example. The Scottish referendum on the 18th of September has an unusual electorate because they've reduced the voting age to 16 for the question of whether Scotland should be independent. And this has been much debated in itself, with many people accusing the Scottish government, which is in the hands of Yes Vote people, of wanting to co-opt young people on an assumption that young people will tend to vote yes. But all of the surveys now done say that young people between 16 and 18 are more inclined to vote no than yes. And the reason is they see themselves very much as connected to a broader world. Social media has changed their understanding of what matters and what their future's like to be like, and they're worried about being too constrained by a national identity and setup that might restrict their ability to have a life that floats across national borders. A very unexpected finding. It may in the end be what decides the referendum, but not at all the sort of picture people had in their heads of what a 16-year-old might think. A very sophisticated, very mature, and if I may say, very insightful view of what it is that their future might hold. Now, you wouldn't want to get carried away about what young people might not know.
Oh, that is interesting. And Barry, civics education, has it in the past fallen victim to the culture wars rhetoric? When you talk about the establishment of political and legal institutions in Australia, you are essentially talking about the British influence in Australia, and that's not too far away from talking about colonisation and therefore the treatment of Aboriginal people. And you then get into difficult areas where some on the conservative side say we should be celebrating our British heritage more than others, for example.
Yeah, look, I think the culture wars affected history more than civics and citizenship. There was some claim, of course, that the history, if it paid too much attention to Indigenous issues, for example, or Asian issues, which we think it needs to pay attention to as well these days, we're in the midst of the so-called Asian century, but before that was brought out, we were already said that the curriculum ought to deal with Australia's engagement with Asia. So all of that's true in the history curriculum. And then people might look into there and say, well, where is the Westminster tradition? Where is our political arrangements? Where do we understand where our legal system comes from? Well, it's to some extent in the history curriculum, but it's front and centre in the civics and citizenship curriculum. So you have to look at the whole to see whether it's balanced. And I don't think the civics and citizenship has fallen foul of the culture wars.
Minister, do you get a sense there's some political momentum at a national level? I mean, when the state ministers get together, is this a topic that is discussed, how we can get a better, broader civics education across the nation?
No, Paul, we're usually concerned with things like...
Buckets of money.
The buckets of money for the National Partnership for Early Childhood, which expires end of this year. The last year was preoccupied with the Gonski debate and future funding for schools. But we do, we get a report from Barry McGaugh and ACARA, as we do from some of the other overseeing bodies that were set up over the last few years. But, of course, there are things that we discuss and debate amongst ourselves. Mm. Look, there's no doubt when you ask about some of those issues, when I think back to my own time in state schooling in the 1970s and 80s, that I think that young students are very interested in issues of the world. Mm. They just may not be interested in the politics of our local world specifically, but they are certainly interested, and they get far more exposure to aspects of Indigenous issues. Mm. And they are wonderful young citizens. We certainly shouldn't be writing them off. Mm. It's just a matter of saying that we would always, in our own jobs, in my job, be interested in having people who are more interested in the things that we do.
Mm. I think we're seeing, though, quite a change in the way in which people engage. If I look to my generation, more particularly my parents' generation, particularly my parents' generation, you would say they were sort of a generation of joiners. Joined organisations. They stayed there. They were life members. More recently, there's no less level of engagement, but the engagement tends to be around an issue, around an event, and it's transient. People will move from one issue to another. Their levels of engagement will step up and step down. I mean, the critical thing, for, as I see it, of civics education is equipping those in our community with a knowledge about how our community works and how governance works within our community, and also enabling people to participate, to engage, providing some of the tools and helping to understand how they their engagement in whatever cause or issue that they want to engage can have an impact and maybe produce the sort of outcomes that they wish to see. Mm. It's not about understanding necessarily, you know, thoroughly the institutions, the organisational players as such. And I think that's a subtlety which sometimes is lost in the debate.
Barry, what's the state of Australian history in our schools? Because there is a close relationship, obviously, between civics and citizenship and our history.
Well, history persisted in New South Wales to an extent it hadn't in other states. But the first four subjects completed in the national curriculum are English, math, science and history, and they are all implemented now in every state and territory in Australia from kindergarten, or what we call foundation year, to year 10. Mm. The reason we call it foundation year, having been asked to develop a curriculum for K to 12, was K means the year before the year before year one in Western Australia. It means the year before year one in some parts of Australia, but the year before year one in other parts of Australia is called transition, prep, preschool, and so on. So we said to the officials, could you choose a single name to be used for the year before year one? Mm. And they said no. So we chose foundation. And my guess is in a decade, everyone will be saying F to 10, F to 12. Not because we wanted that, but because no one else would decide.
I think that tells us a bit about the
Australian federal system.
Indeed, it
tells
it does. Us about, yes. Glyn, what's the state of Australian history at universities? Melbourne University, for example, has had an illustrious history, really, of teaching Australian history over the years. How are your enrolments holding up there these days?
And indeed remains a centre for Australian history with a very proud record and some superb staff. But it would be fair to say over the last decade, at least from the Melbourne numbers, I can't speak for any other institution, there has been a fall. Mm. Australian history used to attract a very substantial group of tertiary students and attracts far fewer now. The explanation often given, and it's a bit hard to test, is that because more students do Australian history in high school, they are less inclined to do so to continue at university. They feel they've done that and they want to do something they couldn't do at high school. Mm. So it may be perversely that introducing Australian history across the high school curriculum has actually diminished enrolments at universities. It's a difficult argument to test. The numbers are down 20% or so over where we were a decade ago. All subjects go through cycles, and we may yet see a return. There's no doubt that the 2015 Gallipoli anniversary will spark a lot of interest in a whole range of related questions, and we may see a rise coming out of that. Big national events tend to do that. The Bicentenary did that. The Centenary of Federation did that. So, like most things in our community, interest never disappears, but it waxes and wanes, and we're going through a waning period, and at some point it'd be nice to report that it's turned the corner.
That was Professor Glyn Davis, Vice-Chancellor at the University of Melbourne and former head of the Queensland Premier's Department. You also heard from Professor Barry McGaw, Chair of the Board of ACARA, the Australian Curriculum Assessment and Reporting Authority, Dr. David Hamill, former minister in the Goss and Beattie governments in Queensland, and John Paul Langbroke, Queensland Minister for Education, Training and Employment, and a former leader of the Queensland Opposition. That discussion on civics and citizenship was held, as you heard, before the Scottish independence referendum, thanks to the Queensland branch of the Australasian Study of Parliament Group. That's it for Big Ideas for tonight. You can let us know your thoughts on our discussions by visiting our website, abc.net.au/rn/big ideas. And while you're there, you can download or podcast past programs. Thanks for listening. Hope you can join me again on Big Ideas tomorrow when former Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser argues we should cut all military ties with the US. Until then, bye for now.
problem is not just a difficult problem, it's a problem where when you solve one bit, you create equally intractable problems.
And the wicked problem in question is what to do about the uncivil nature of online discourse.
We're not quite sure if this is the right form for our readers to interact with one another, and if that's the form that we as news organizations should provide.
Dealing with digital discord, that's Future Tense. Download the program from the RN website or look for us on iTunes.